Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-16-413, State of Petrillo. Arguing for the petitioner, Garcia Forrester, Deputy Public Defender. Arguing for the respondent, Michael Kagami, Special Deputy Attorney General. Argument on the merits.
All right. Are counsel both ready to proceed today? Ms. Forrester, you have a 5 minutes rebuttal. We'll give you a warning light. Mr. Kagami, 5 minutes for you when we're at that point in your argument. Justice McKenna?
Before we proceed, I would like to place on the record the following disclosure. One of my law clerks received a call this morning to have an interview scheduled at the public defender's office on Monday. So I want to disclose that this law clerk will perform no further work on this case. Thank you.
Very well. Please proceed.
May it please the court, Deputy Public Defender Garcia Forrester on behalf of the petitioner, Chief Justice Rechtenwald and Associate Justices. The Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred by misconstruing the intent of the statute of limitations and misconstruing State v. Stans Contracting. Stans Contracting stands for the simple proposition that discovery of a scheme starts the clock for calculation of the statute of limitations for fraud cases.
That's really not a holding of Stans Contracting, is it?
That I would agree that's not the exact holding. It was a different fact pattern, a different type of fraudulent scheme. However, it did. There was language about schemes. Put simply, our position is that counts 4, 5, and 6 of the felony information were all part of the same scheme, a scheme to defraud the WCO of monies. They were not separate offenses as defined by the ICA to be given different discovery dates.
Isn't that a jury question as to whether or not it's all, you know, committed with one objective, one intent, one plan? Isn't that something the jury's going to have to conclude once the judge instructs them and gives them a merger instruction?
So, unfortunately, merger is not something that was discussed as part of the case or part of the pretrial motion that led to this appeal and then thus being here today. So I'm not going to be really addressing merger. However, we would argue that no, it's a matter of law. It's when the discovery date begins and therefore when the state has the ability and the jurisdiction to charge someone in a court of law. So we would argue that it's a matter of law. Excuse me.
Who decides? How do you find out when discovery occurred? Isn't that based on testimony? Isn't that an interpretation of fact?
I need a second.
No.
Why don't you think about it?
Yeah, if I may.
You can come back to it, no problem.
I'd like to come back to that, if that's okay.
Yep.
Okay. So the ICA concluded that each count of the felony information constitutes a separate offense or separate transaction for purposes of the statute of limitations, thus disregarding the plain language of HRS 701-108 subsection 3A and the language in Stans Contracting that refers to a scheme. It's our position that discovery of the scheme starts the clock. For purposes of this case, discovery was made by the WCO, who was the aggrieved party. The language aggrieved party comes from HRS 701-108.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but since you're on this point, Ms. Forrester, if I could ask you, with respect to your view of when the discovery took place, is it your view that when the WCO Executive Director Plasencia noticed there was something irregular in May of 2010, yes, that's when the discovery would take place?
Yes, 100%. Discovery was made in May of 2010. Sometime during May of 2010, that is when Ms. Petrillo left her employment at the WCO. Whether she was fired or she just abandoned her job is in dispute, but she definitely left her employment and never returned after May of 2010.
But would you agree that the actual facts underlying counts 4, 5, and 6 pertain to transactions that were discovered by somebody other than Ms. Plasencia? It was after the investigation started in September.
So Thank you for the question. Our position is the discovery was made by the WCO in May of 2010 when they discovered financial irregularities involving Ms. Pitolo and thus began the investigation and the 3 years for them to complete their investigation, work with law enforcement, and do whatever they needed to do to pursue charges.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the actual transactions that constituted counts 4, 5, and 6 were discovered after the state took over, right?
So my answer is it depends on your definition of transaction, because we don't agree with the ICA's definition of
maybe
transaction.
I can just ask to get some clarification just factually. Factually, Ms. Placencia didn't notice those transactions or report them that were the basis of counts 4, 5, and 6, right?
Ms. Placencia noticed some of the transactions. For the basis for counts 4, 5, and 6, those transactions were discovered sometime, those specific transactions were discovered sometime between June of 2010 and the date of the filing of the civil suit by the WCO.
Isn't that what the jury, I think that's what Justice Nakayama was asking you then. We don't know. We don't know when it was discovered. And isn't that, again, a factual finding that the jury's going to have to make to determine maybe they did know about it, maybe the agency knew about it earlier than before it filed a civil complaint, maybe the police knew. At this point, we don't know. And I think you're asking a court to make a finding as a matter of law, and the court really isn't in that position to do this.
I would agree that we don't have all the facts concerning the exact dates of discovery that the WCO made when they started looking into the irregular financial transactions. We know at some point they found it, because when they filed their civil suit, they included all the methods that were used. The methods that were used included ATM transactions, debit card transactions, and the writing of unauthorized checks. And all of those methods were included in their civil suit. So at some point, they did become aware of all the different types. But we don't know the exact date, because that was not disclosed in the documents that they filed when they filed their civil suit.
Then how can you know when the statute began to run if you don't know the date of discovery?
The position that we're taking is that the statute of limitations was designed to basically light a fire under whoever the wronged party is. In this case, it was the WCO. So what happens is they discover there's problems. So what's required then is for them to look under the hood and figure out what the nature of the problem is and all the different things that need to be fixed or discovered, so that they can figure out what they're going to do about it. So it's not that all the transactions need to be found by that date. The date of discovery is not the date that every single check that was ever written is discovered. It's the date that there's financial irregularities and an investigation needs to ensue.
You know, this, I think it was the state in their brief came up with an interesting hypothetical, and it was that let's suppose there's this scheme, and the scheme is ongoing. Under the argument that you're making, the police would have to discover a check that hadn't even been written yet, because it's part of the same scheme if you're going to put a duty on them. I mean, usually discovery means something that's been discovered, not something that maybe could have or should have.
The flip side of that is, if this court accepts the ICA's definition of transaction and how they treat a scheme as basically an offense, which is basically a type of transaction, then there's an unlimited statute of limitations, and it would encourage abuse. So essentially, an organization or law enforcement can say, all right, we've discovered a problem here, but we're going to have a dilatory or a sloppy or an ineffectual investigation, or we're going to choose to ignore it, put it on the side, and then 6 years later, oh, let's take a good look now. Now we've discovered additional transactions from way back when. So you have to balance that. Our problem is that we're concerned that this will invite an abuse of the statute of limitations and allow people to then stretch it out because they're not going to do due diligence.
Can I interrupt you just for a sec so you can complete that thought from what Justice Pollack was asking? Because I'm trying to understand how you would apply the statute in a situation in which the discovery of the incident, in, so to speak, is noticed by an aggrieved party, and it's not reported for quite a long time, but the fraudulent scheme continues. So from your point of view, if the aggrieved party, say in this case, like an NGO in this case, reported to the police transactional evidence of fraud that took place 10 years ago, and the police, in investigating, noticed that not only did it take place then, that it's continued up until the present, is it your view that you'd have to, because it's could be considered a continuing course, that there wouldn't be any conduct that could be prosecuted because the discovery had taken place by an aggrieved party so long ago?
Yes. The statute of limitations should be a hard and fast rule, not something fungible that can be sort of, that's malleable, that can be changed. It's sort of like the Rule 48 rule. Either you make the deadline or you don't make the deadline. They had 3 years to do their investigation, and it stalled. Part and parcel because HPD dropped the ball, because the WCO and their board of directors dropped the ball. So we're not.
Weren't there other victims and or folks who were used to further the fraud in terms of having checks made out to them and or different types of transactions, debit transactions instead of checks written to folks that she knew? So there are other aspects of the fraudulent scheme which may not have been readily apparent.
I would agree that in May of 2010, when they first realized that there were financial irregularities, it may not have been readily apparent. But then they should have done their investigation. They should have had accountants look at their books. They should have had an auditor from DHS come in and perhaps get involved.
How do we know that they didn't? I mean, not only are we making assumptions about what they did, I mean, I'm troubled by this test that perhaps requires a should have discovered, but even if we did adopt such a test, we would have to have a full-on hearing, which the court certainly couldn't do on a, you know, in fact, it would have to be done based by the jury, and everyone in the police department who worked on the case would have to be subpoenaed, and every witness would have to be subpoenaed, and to verify what they told or they didn't tell, or, I mean, it's a very, very complex scenario that you're advocating.
I would agree it's messy, especially when you have complicated financial fraud cases, which I'll say this case was messy, but not necessarily complicated.
Well, the messiness that I think Justice is referring to is sort of addressed in the Stans case, isn't it, where the court said, I think Justice Levinson said it's necessary to state in the charging document the dates of discovery so that it's clear that the statute of limitations has been complied with. So if that's the case, wouldn't you consider it would be a factual determination that needs to be, you know, decided by the jury?
So I'm not sure if it's a factual determination that needs to be made by a jury versus by the court.
But isn't it your view that that's a burden of proof is on the government to actually prove during the course of the case that there has been a compliance with the statute of limitation by presenting evidence to show that the discovery of the offense took place within the 3-year period that would apply to fraud?
Well, I would agree that the burden of proof would require them to prove what they've placed in their felony information and what the exact charges are. So I would agree with that.
Ms. Forrester, one of your concerns is that the government could go back and revitalize stale counts. But as a matter of fact, didn't you get the relief that you wanted because the circuit court dismissed counts 1, 2, and 3?
Well, I would consider that partial relief because, well, the circuit court dismissed all counts, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6.
Oh,
so,
that's right.
So,
that's
right. So yes, we did get that's the relief right. okay. that we okay. sought at the lower court, but for purposes of today, I was only going to be focused on counts 4, 5, and 6, but I'm certainly able to talk about counts 1, 2, and 3.
That's okay. So even if you if the 4, 5, and 6 are reinstated, they're not stale counts the way 1, 2, and 3 were.
We would disagree.
You're asking us to find that this was one big continuous offense, continuing offense.
Yes.
As a matter of law, this is all one continuing offense.
One scheme.
However, our case law does say that whether or not there's a general intent or a specific intent as to, that's a question of fact. So you're asking us to be fact finders.
Well, we're asking the court to look at the purpose of a statute of limitations in the context of financial fraud cases under the extension that is allowed under the statute of limitations.
Isn't the issue of whether or not this was brought within 3 years of discovery by an aggrieved party a question of fact? First of all, are you conceding that the state of Hawaii is an aggrieved party here?
I would consider them an agent of the aggrieved party, but the original aggrieved party is the WCO.
And right now, we don't know when you say that in September 2013, when they filed the civil complaint, they included these transactions that were covered in 4, 5, and 6, counts 4, 5, and 6. Correct. So we don't know when WCO, the aggrieved party, actually discovered this, correct?
That is correct. We do not know the exact date or month that they specifically discovered, like, the debit transactions. All we know is they started an investigation in May of 2010. They involved HPD. They had two different reports, the original report and then the follow-up report. The investigation then stalled. Nothing then happened, and they never pursued it.
But you're talking about HPD's investigation and the state of Hawaii's investigation as compared to the internal investigation. We don't actually know when WCO's agents, their auditors or whatever they must have hired before they filed this lawsuit, or we don't know when they discovered it.
We do not.
And in order for the government to survive the motion to dismiss, what was the government required to show? In other words, the counts 1, 2, and 3 have been sustained the dismissal. In essence, what your motion did at circuit court was to call into question whether there was sufficient evidence, whether there was enough for probable cause in the affidavit supporting the information to show that the statute of limitations was not, as a matter of law, expired. So all the government really had to show was either this, you know, the CID police report or the declaration, which I think they submitted from the investigator.
They had to show that the date of discovery was not May 27th, 2010, when it was clear from the documents that we submitted that the WCO, or at least that the executive director claimed that that's when she first noticed financial irregularities. The parties at the lower level agreed basically to the dates that were set forth in the AG's investigation about the timeline that they used. But we do not agree that the aggrieved party in this case is the Attorney General's office. The aggrieved party was the WCO. The Attorney General's office sort of came later to assist with the investigation, but the aggrieved party for purposes of the statute of limitations is the WCO and what they discovered and then what investigation they did at that point.
Your position, I think, is supported by Stans from the point of view that an aggrieved party is not necessarily the government, right? Because in Stans, the court said that it would be necessary in order for the government to meet its burden to show that the statute was complied with, it would be necessary to get an affidavit from, in that case, the aggrieved party that was, the construction company. So, but nonetheless, if it's the aggrieved party, you still have this issue, don't you, of intent? That is, there has to be a determination whether the aggrieved party was discovering an offense that had an intent that was a continuing intent, as opposed to perhaps the intent changing as the different method occurred. Sometimes an ATM was used, sometimes a check was used. But theoretically, that might be evidence that there was a change in intent, so there wasn't necessarily, as Justice McKenna said, there wasn't necessarily this continuing intent. Isn't that a factual question? See if it was a continuing conduct case?
I think that would have to be a finding that the court would have to make, not necessarily the jury, as a matter of law, not necessarily a decision that a jury would have to review and decide.
Well, isn't the jury going to be required to determine what was the intent with respect to each of these offenses? Right? They have to determine whether there's an intent to defraud, and if there was, for how much, and what the nature of the intent was.
If this case had gone to trial, then the jury would have to decide whether there was an intent to defraud, not necessarily an intent as to for purposes of statute of limitations. So I think those might be two different kind of questions.
I think what we're trying to say is, as the ICA said in footnote 13, the determination of whether a defendant may be convicted of more than one offense based on whether the evidence discloses one general intent or discloses separate and distinct intents is a question of fact that must be decided by the trier of fact after trial, and that quoting State versus Matias. So, basically, it's going to be up to the jury to determine whether 4, 5, 6 is one general intent or specific intents as to each scheme or offense that is alleged in those counts. And if the jury says it's one general intent, all three counts are going to merge and there's going to be one conviction on one offense.
So that would be sort of a special interrogatory having to do with murder and or a special interrogatory having to do with whether they agree or disagree there was one specific intent.
I assume that's how it's handled, a special interrogatory.
Our concern is that in the way that the case was charged, the state had so many different ways that they could have figured out how to charge it.
They could have charged 1,000 counts.
They could have. So we have a problem with determining what a scheme is, what an offense is, and what a transaction is. Our biggest concern with the ICA's decision is that they're treating the term scheme as being sort of equal with the term offense, and then they're adding on that it also could involve a transaction, and without giving further information on what that transaction is.
But a scheme can be an offense. In fact, you initially were arguing that it is not a good thing that when offenses appear, say, one a year or something like that, and that but if it is one scheme, using that in the same context of a merger, and it's one, then it's the last one from which the statute of limitations is triggered.
If I may have misspoke. So we're not concerned about offense and scheme. We're concerned about the extension that the ICA made to treat a transaction as then each transaction can be treated as a scheme. So that's more, I think, what we're concerned about, and the extension that each transaction can be treated as a separate scheme.
Well, what the law says is that the last, let me read it. An offense is committed either when every element occurs. So if it's one offense with lots of transactions, in other words, it's committed with one state of mind, then the last one will still be part of the scheme, because it's an element of it.
I don't have a problem with that statement. But for purposes of this case, all transactions were completed, and there were no further transactions or offenses. And the scheme was completed by June of 2010. So we did not have an ongoing continuing scheme past the date of June of 2008.
It's actually July 16th in count one.
Oh, I apologize. Excuse me. July 2010. I apologize.
Would you like to reserve your remaining time for rebuttal?
Yes, please. I see the light.
Very well. Thank you. And we'll hear from Mr. Kagami at this point.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice and Associate Justices.
Good morning.
First of all, I think I'm bothered by when the petitioner uses the word scheme, and Stan does use scheme. The problem is that the fraud exception tolling provision 701-1083A does not contain the word scheme. It contains the word discovery of the offense. That's the operative phrase. Now, 701-1084 then defines what an offense can be. And in this case, what the state has done is basically taking a series of different separate offenses and charge one offense. So then the issue becomes, well, when is the discovery of offense? When you have these multiple offenses making up one offense. Now, the petitioner's position is that, well, if you found one, you found them all. But there's no justification for that. And I think if you look at the purpose of 701-1083A, the purpose the legislature in enacting that statute was that it recognized the difficulty of discovering criminal activity that's hidden among legitimate transactions, where you can have false or misleading documentation or record keeping, and where you're looking at these transactions months or even years after the fact.
Mr. Kagami, who has... It's the discovery by whom?
It's by the aggrieved party or someone who represents that aggrieved
party. So would that be WCO is the aggrieved party?
Our position was that in this case it would be the WCO and the state, because the state was providing the funds to WCO for their operation.
So in other words, if a corporation is stolen from, the bank that lent it money is the aggrieved party?
I wouldn't say that, no.
So why is the state an aggrieved party in this case? Because the state funded a nonprofit, they are the aggrieved party?
That's how we've taken it, yes. But I do see your point.
Well, clearly WCO is
an
aggrieved party.
Right. And I agree, among the earlier discussion, factually we don't know what that date is.
And you allege here that, I'm sorry, your counts, each count alleges, the state further alleges, this is based on Stan's contracting, the requirements of Stan's contracting that you include for probable cause purposes, notice purposes, the date of earliest date of discovery. You allege that the earliest date of discovery of the offense by the state of Hawaii or by a person who has a legal duty to represent the state of Hawaii and who was not a party to the offense was after September 5, 2013.
That's correct.
What happens if the state of Hawaii is not an aggrieved party for purposes of extension under 701-108.
Then factually, we would need to determine when WCO found out about it.
Does that invalidate these counts, these indictments? I mean, this information, these charges?
Potentially, the state may have not met its statute of limitations. That's correct. Depending on what...
Is this potentially a defective information charge?
Potentially.
And then, Mr. Kagami, it's your view, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the court would make a determination pre-trial? You accept that the court would make a determination pre-trial about whether the statute of limitations has been met, as opposed to the jury making a determination that's based on, I guess the jury at some point is going to have to decide whether it's a continuing course, right?
Right. The jury needs to make several determinations. When did WCO or the state find out? What is it, one scheme or one course of conduct? And the different factual scenarios presented by the court earlier.
You keep saying WCO or the state. Can you explain to me? It's like both have to have known or one or what? It's kind of coming, following up on Justice McKenna's question.
Under our view of the how we charge it, either.
Either had to know? I'm sorry. So
either WCO or the state.
Whichever one was the first to know? Is
correct.
That what you're saying?
Okay.
A grieved party is not defined by statute, is it?
No.
Would the rule of lenity apply here? To not include the State of Hawaii Department of Attorney General within a grieved party? Well, who are we talking about? Are we talking about DHS? Who are we talking about?
DHS. What?
DHS. So you're arguing that DHS. The DHS cases that we've had, it's actually like welfare fraud. They're clearly the aggrieved party because it's welfare fraud.
Yes.
But you are asking us to extend that to say that whenever a government provides funding to a nonprofit or to a separate entity, the state as the funder becomes an aggrieved party. That, in my view, would mean that we would have to recognize the banks that lend money to corporations as aggrieved parties if that corporation, you know, if there's theft or pilfering from that corporation. Do you think the rule of lenity would allow that?
I'm not sure I can answer that question at this time.
So the record doesn't disclose whether WCO knew about ATM cash. So count four is ATM cash withdrawals, right? It's my understanding.
Count four.
Correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, and so the record, as you understand it, doesn't disclose whether WCO was aware of the implication of that specific type of fraud as of 2010?
The record does not disclose when they knew.
When they learned.
If ever, yeah.
Do you disagree with defense counsel that when the civil WCO filed a civil complaint, they did include the transactions that are included in 4, 5, and 6, counts 4, 5, and 6?
The specific transactions?
Well, you've charged each one as a continuing course of conduct. So ATM transactions, debit card transactions, and that check written to the landlord.
I don't dispute that the civil complaint contained those different courses of conduct. Whether or not what the specifics...
So that was July, right? The complaint was filed.
That's correct.
Of what year?
2013.
Of 13.
Correct.
So you filed within 3 years of that, correct? You filed your information within 3 years of the civil complaint, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so the question is, did they know sooner than that? And that's what the question that the record doesn't show.
That's correct.
So you would concede if at trial, there was evidence that WCO knew about ATM transactions, checks to the landlord, or debit transactions back in 2011, that would mean that the case was not timely brought?
That's correct.
And that's last question. That's a question that you believe should be decided by the jury? Or would you concede that's a jury question?
I would concede that's a jury question.
Would you concede if there was discovery that indicated that WCO or the aggrieved party and or agents that had a legal duty to represent WCO, questionable whether that would be its auditors and or attorneys?
Correct.
Knew?
Correct.
More than 3 years before this, the information was filed, what would the state's position be at that time?
Well, I see that as being a basis for a motion to dismiss again, and I believe the state would not prevail.
Okay, on July 2013, WCO files a complaint.
Correct.
And then you folks file your, is it an information, as Justice McKinney
said? That's correct.
Yeah, you file a felony information on in March and say that all in March 2015 and say everything was discovered after September 5th, 2013.
That's correct.
And that's based on when the AGs came in and started investigating?
No, that's when DHS started their investigation. At the time of the information, we were not aware of the civil suit. We weren't aware of the civil suit.
Oh, okay.
But the findings are confusing because what the court's findings indicate is that on July 25th, 2013, when the civil complaint is filed, it doesn't say, of course, when Y&I Community, WCO, learned of that. But then, because of that complaint, the Attorney General's office gets involved, and according to the findings, the investigators with the Office of AG took over the investigation, and in the course of their investigation, the AG's office located a number of additional alleged unauthorized transactions not specified in the original police report or the supplemental police report. But we don't know if those were additional to what WCO found in 2013 or whether or not WCO had known about those beforehand.
Right. I think what that additional is referring to is outside of the police report made in 2010.
But the amounts that WCO filed suit in, isn't it about, doesn't it correspond to the amounts that are alleged in this case?
I believe they're pretty close.
Because WCO civil complaint included $762,000 of theft.
Correct. We just don't know what transactions or specific transactions made up those amounts.
But I'm
responded to CJ's question, the Chief Justice's question about that it was, I think he thought it was a factual question as to the statute of limitations. But on a motion to dismiss, aren't you required to come forward with at least a probable cause basis to believe the information has been timely filed?
That's correct.
And is there anything in the record that would show, when the court made the decision, that WCO did not have that information more than, earlier?
There's nothing in the record to establish when WCO found out.
One way or the other.
Correct.
And is perhaps that, it maybe, and I don't know, Justice McKenna was pointing out, I believe, that you didn't allege that WCO didn't know about the information. In each of the six counts, what you allege was the earliest date of the discovery of the offense by the state or a person who had a legal duty to represent the state of Hawaii. It doesn't allege WCO.
That's correct, because at that time we weren't aware of the civil suit by WCO. We were just aware that DHS has begun in their investigation in September of 2013.
Those events were purely coincidental? I'm sorry, perhaps I misunderstood. You weren't aware there was a suit?
I wasn't personally aware.
Okay. The agency was, or you just don't know?
I'm not sure because I did not see anywhere in the records that.
Oh no, it's pretty clear that the DHS saw the news regarding the civil suit, and somebody in the DHS saw it, and that's why they started investigating.
No, it was the AG investigator that saw the news clip. That's when he contacted HPD, and that's when he contacted DHS.
Now, the AG investigator saw the news clip about the DHS investigation.
Right.
Okay, but just to follow up on Justice Pollack's question, what you're indicating is the record in this case at the time the motion was decided does not indicate that WCO had any knowledge of the types of transactions or the categories of transactions that were charged in counts 4, 5, and 6, correct?
I'm sorry, could you please repeat?
Okay. The record as it existed when the motion was ruled on, as Justice Pollack pointed out, presumably there has to at least be a showing of probable cause to support the allegations in the complaint. Right. So presumably what your representation to us is that there was nothing in the record to indicate that WCO knew anything about the types of conduct charged in counts 4, 5, and 6 prior to September 5th of 2013. Thought you told me that already. Perhaps you misunderstood my question. Is there anything in the record? Because you told me on remand, if the jury found that that was a case, there would be a statute of limitations issue if it was outside the 3 years. So what's the status of the record now on that with regard to that? Is there anything, I presume you know?
Outside the complaint itself, there's no other information regarding when WCO found out.
So the other materials, police reports, none of the other stuff that was before the circuit court has any bearing or says anything about that issue? Is that your representation?
Only the police report in 2010. Those certain transactions.
Okay.
Outside of the complaint, that's the only thing in the record that establishes they found out or knew about.
Right.
Well, how did the circuit court make a finding then that on July 25th, 2013, WCO filed a civil complaint totaling $762,000 from 2007 through 2010? So the issue, the civil complaint alleging amounts that are comparable to your information was before the circuit court on the motion to dismiss, right?
That's correct.
And do you dispute at all, Mr. Kagami, that this is a continuing course, that the evidence is clear that it was one intent as opposed to discrete separate acts?
There is one intent with respect to those different courses of conduct, that's correct.
So you allege
this one overarching intent, therefore we should be charging basically one offense. No, I don't agree with that.
You should be charging one offense, obviously, right?
Well,
in other words, this isn't like a series of bank robberies that take place over a couple of years where there's clearly two distinct intents or three distinct intents, depending on how many robberies took place.
Right. The way we charged it was that different courses of conduct, checks to a certain person, checks to another person, debit withdrawals, debit ATM cash withdrawals. We agree there's a singular intent within those courses of conduct. We don't agree that there's this overarching single intent, thus that, you know, we should have only charged one offense.
I mean, you have discretion to charge it the way, but it's going to be up to it. Assuming the case moves forward, it would be up to the fact finder.
That's correct.
It could be one continuing offense. And your decision to decide to charge it separately doesn't necessarily mean a conclusion that there were different intents as to the overall scheme, correct?
No, because I agree that can come up for the jury to decide whether or not there's a merger.
So what happened here was HPD was informed in August of 2010, and then they were waiting for more documents from Ms. Palencia, who apparently reported it.
Correct.
In the first case, in the first instance. But
that's
then
correct.
Your investigation revealed that she had actually also stolen over $500,000?
Right. She's, I think, been sentenced already.
Anything further at this time, Mr. Kagami, you wanted to bring to our attention?
No, I just wanted to emphasize, I think petitioner's argument seems to be that there's this one scheme, therefore if you find one, you find all. And I think if you look at the legislative intent of the fraud exception statute, I think that runs counter to that purpose. And I think the court, when construing or interpreting a statute, should look at, you know, what was the purpose of the legislation. Also like to point out, you know, we did charge different courses of conduct, and that's based on different methods. You also have different beneficiaries of that conduct. You know, one set of checks went to Ms. Bitolo's father, benefited him. Another set of checks went to a coworker. You know, so we have these different courses of conduct. And it shouldn't be you find one, you find them all, because that really wouldn't make any sense. And I think if you look at the language of 708-801 subsection 6, it contemplates that there can be more than one scheme or courses of conduct within theft. Other than that, that's all I have.
Thank you very much.
You.
Ms. Forster, your rebuttal.
So the history of this case is a classic example of what a statute of limitations was designed to cure. Stale claims, these are stale claims. Neglected claims, these were neglected claims. The loss of evidence, the loss of witnesses, the loss of documentation. In this case, it appears that the executive director may have destroyed documents, and the destruction of documents.
And isn't through the passage of time, though, is it? Isn't that she was also involved in illegal doings at the...
Yes. Unfortunately, it appears that there were two separate people allegedly stealing from the WCO around the same time, doing their own independent thefts. So that appears to be what has happened. In conclusion, the statute of limitations was not broken in this case. It worked as it was designed to work. It set a 3-year deadline, and the aggrieved party, the WCO, failed to meet that deadline. The failure in this case was the failure of the WCO to run their organization in a fiscally responsible manner and the failure of the DHS to conduct proper audits. But these failures should not prompt this court to adopt the ICA's interpretation of Stan's contracting. Stan's contracting was clear. Discovery of the scheme starts the statute of limitations clock, and the scheme was discovered by the WCO on May 27, 2010. And the 3-year statute of limitations expired prior to the filing of the felony information in this case in 2015.
I just want to make sure I'm clear here. You are arguing because HPD was informed of 8 checks totaling $8,434 in 2010, they should have known that there was a theft of over $760,000.
No, that's not what we're saying. We're okay. saying that the WCO knew that they had financial problems, and they should have done a proper due diligence investigation of what was going on.
Isn't that really an issue for the civil case? I mean, you know, they have to meet the statute of limitations in the civil case. If they filed it on July 25th, 2013, there could be a statute of limitations defense there, arguing that they had to file it within 2 years of when WCO knew or should have known that they had, that this tort had occurred. However, in the criminal context, it's actual discovery. I don't see any language that says should have known. Where is their law that says it's the discovery is defined as when the aggrieved party should have known?
There's nothing that specifically says should have known, so I will acknowledge that. But the problem is, if you flip it, then we're encouraging an abuse of the statute of limitations by artificially extending it, by failing to use due diligence and take a look at what you've got when you discover financial irregularities, especially when it comes to fraud cases. So we're concerned that the statute of limitations is basically going to be diluted, and the concept of a hard and fast rule, get your act together, do what you need to do your investigations, is going to be diluted and extended.
But in this case, you actually haven't done the discovery as to when WCO actually discovered these acts.
We don't have that information
right
today. Yes. Thank you. That's
very
all
well. Thank you very much
to
our attorneys here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Thank you. Honorable.